He was a self-serving official working his way up the ladder of Roman government. He was cruel and insensitive to the people he ruled over. Yet despite the Jews' cry for blood at the trial of Jesus, he showed an amazing restraint. Welcome to the Bible Study Hour, a radio and internet broadcast with Dr. James Boyce, preparing you to think and act biblically. What caused this calloused man to try to protect the king of the Jews? Why did he act out of character when it came to the Savior? Let's join Dr. Boyce as he investigates John chapter 18, examining the motives of the man who held the power of life and death in Judea, that far-flung territory of the Roman government.
If you're visiting with us, you should know that we're in the midst of a series here dealing with characters that are presented to us at some length in the Gospel of John. We're studying the 18th and 19th chapters of the Gospel where Jesus is on trial before Pilate, who is the governor in Jerusalem, the occupying powers being the Roman powers in that day. And in the context of this trial, we get really an insightful description of this man, Pilate. I say he's startling to have in this series for a number of reasons. For one thing, he's a Gentile, and he's the only Gentile of those that we have been studying to be found in the list. I suppose the woman of Samaria is a quasi-Gentile because the Samaritans were of mixed blood. They were part Gentile and part Jewish. It's one of the reasons the pure-blooded Jews looked down on them, but she somewhat qualifies. You have the feeling that she, along with all of the others, more or less belongs there in that area of the world. That's her culture. But that's not the case with Pilate. Pilate is a representative of Rome. The Roman legions had conquered the area. And so here he comes forward as a real Gentile and a powerful one at that. Another thing that's striking about it is the amount of space that's given over to him. 35 verses altogether that are given over to the exchange between Jesus and this man, Pilate. Now, Pilate is a great mystery, as we see him in the Gospels, and for a couple reasons. Let me begin to explain the first. First of all, we know something about Pilate's character from non-biblical sources. That's to be expected. He was a figure of some power and influence, and so he's written about elsewhere. Josephus, especially, who writes the history of the Jewish people, has a full description of Pilate, including many events from his earlier life, particularly, that are not mentioned in the Gospels. How would you describe him? Well, I think you'd have to say that he was an immoral opportunist at best. He didn't come from this area of the world. To start with, he was a Spaniard. He grew up in Seville, Spain. He entered the Roman legions and served under Germanicus, the great general on the Rhine, where they were fighting the German barbarians of the time. After there was peace in those battles, a temporary peace, Pilate came to Rome and he began to try and work his way up into a position of power because now he was there at the very center of the Roman government. He met a woman who he married. His name was Claudia Procula, and in a political sense, that was the making of Pilate, because Claudia Procula was the daughter of Julia, who was the daughter of the Emperor Augustus. Augustus was the great emperor, and so by marrying the emperor's granddaughter, he found himself, by marriage, connected to the royal family, and as a result of that, he eventually applied for and was awarded the proconsulship of Judea, which is where we find him here in the story. The problem with it is this: Julia, Augustus's daughter, was a very immoral woman. Now, in the ancient Roman world, you could be pretty immoral and it would still be all right. So when they regarded Julia as immoral, she was really immoral. She was so bad that she was a disgrace to Augustus. And Augustus felt that. And he said on one occasion, "Would that I were wifeless or had childless died." That's how strongly he felt about it. And now here was the daughter of this very immoral woman who was very poorly thought of, and this was the family that Pilate chose to marry into. So as I say, as an opportunist, he succeeded well because he got this position as governor in Judea, but in terms of his life choices, it was something that more upstanding, more moral, noble Romans would not have done. So that's one thing you can say about him. Second thing you can say about him, as far as we know him from the secular sources, is that he was cruel and very insensitive, particularly to the feelings of the people he was sent to govern. Now, that's the kind of man he was. Now, the reason I say that presents a great mystery is that when we come to the account of the trial of Jesus, as we find it in each of the four Gospels, and particularly here in John, where it's spelled out at the greatest length, we find, much to our surprise, that Pilate isn't operating the way we would expect him to be operating from the secular sources. Matter of fact, as far as the actual conduct of the trial is concerned, we find him operating in a most exemplary way. No Roman could have conducted the trial itself. Not what he did afterwards, of course. He had Jesus crucified even when he declared him innocent. But nobody could have conducted that first portion of the trial with any more respect to the law or with any greater order and decency than Pilate did. And that's surprising because as I read this, I suspect that what the Jewish Sanhedrin had done in advance was work out with Pilate what they expected to have been something like a pro forma trial. Pilate didn't care about these Jewish pretenders, these messiahs, and although the Jews did, they had to have his permission to proceed with an execution. So they must have arranged quickly that night of the arrest and their trial with Pilate for Pilate to hear their case and condemn Jesus in a pro forma way early in the morning. Because you see, the Passover was coming. They had to get the execution over quickly. They couldn't afford anything protracted. Otherwise, it would have been better not to have arrested Jesus at the feast and let it go until afterwards. But they were kind of stampeded into this thing, and they must have arranged with Pilate to do it. The reason I say that is because when they finally bring him in, they're presenting him for a very quick verdict and a judgment that would allow the crucifixion to go forward. And Pilate surprises them in verse 29 by asking them what charges they're bringing against him. And you see, they don't have a charge ready. Verse 30, if he were not a criminal, they replied, we would not have handed him over to you. Now, that's not an answer to the governor's question. When the governor asked the question, what charges are you bringing against this man? That is his way of saying, it is my intention now to conduct a formal trial, to do it properly. And they're caught off guard. It's as if they're saying, but we were here last night. You said you were willing to hear this and just do it quickly. What do you mean? What charges? If we didn't have any reason, we wouldn't even be bringing him. But you see, he presses it. Now, John doesn't tell us what happens there. But when you turn to the other Gospels, you find that they were resourceful and they did come forward with an accusation more or less on the spur of the moment. It had a number of parts. They said, this man, Jesus, is going around perverting the nation, and he's telling people not to pay taxes to Caesar, and besides, he makes himself out to be a king. Three parts, you say. Now, the first was vague. He goes around perverting the nation. How does he go around perverting the nation? What's he doing? They didn't specify that. The second of the three accusations was untrue. He says, don't pay taxes to Caesar. As a matter of fact, he said just the opposite. Remember, they tried to trap him on that once. And he asked them for the coin, and he said, whose picture's on it? And Caesar's picture was there. He said, well, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, but make sure you give to God the things that are God. You know, pay the state its due, but make sure you honor God. So he was not guilty of that. But this last thing was something that Pilate would take seriously. He makes himself out to be a king. Now, although John doesn't mention that, as I say, that's implied. Because when Pilate begins the examination, which you find in verse 33, that's the point he fastens on. You see, he asks, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus says, yes, that's right. That's right, I am a king. In fact, this is the very reason I came into the world. I was born in order to be a king. But what that means is to testify to the truth. That's the word he uses. Everyone who is on the side of truth listens to me. So I'm a king, but my kingdom is a kingdom of truth, and I am the truth who is the king of that kingdom. Now, is it any wonder when Pilate heard that, he said what he did? He said, come on, what is truth? That's what you're talking about. This is ridiculous. You're wasting my time. What do I care about kings of truth? You know, I care about kings who control legions and who raise up followers and are trying to drive out Romans. That's the kind of king we care about. You want to be a king of truth, you can be a king of truth all you want. And so he goes out and says, I find no basis for a charge against him. You see, that's a real trial, isn't it? And it's a good one. He forced them to formulate an accusation. He examined Jesus on the basis of the accusation. He allowed him to give a defense. He heard the defense. He recognized its validity, and he pronounced that he wasn't guilty in the end. And not only that, he pronounces him not guilty three times. You find it there in chapter 18, verse 38. I find no basis for a charge against him. You find it in the next chapter, in the fourth verse. I find no basis for a charge against him. And then it's there again in verse 6. I find no basis for a charge against him. So three times over, he says that Jesus is not guilty. Now, doesn't that puzzle you? Here's this man that we have no reason to think highly of, who had no respect for the Jews and their feelings, but who nevertheless, on the occasion of this trial, as it's reported in the Gospels, conducts himself as an exemplary judge and as a model character. It's inconsistent, isn't it? Well, now people have thought about that. Could it be that the secular writers are wrong? They just didn't understand his real character? The answer to this mystery, this dilemma, is found in Matthew's gospel rather than John's gospel, in his account of the trial, Matthew 27, verse 19, which tells us that while Pilate was in the middle of the trial, his wife came to him and she had a message. And her message was, have nothing to do with this innocent man because I have been troubled by many things this night in a dream because of him. Pilate might not have cared a great deal for justice, and he certainly didn't care very much for the Jews, but the Romans were superstitious, and when you had dreams, that was an omen, and you just took that sort of thing seriously. And here was his wife saying, I had a dream, and the dream said, don't have anything to do with this man, and he's innocent. And so when Pilate heard that, he said, well, I'll do what I can to get him off because of what his wife said. That may be speculation, but it seems to me of all the possible suggestions that I've heard, that's probably the best. And so here you have a man now, because of this kind of motivation, no character from within, you see, but this external motivation, wanting to do what's right. And up to this point, what I'm saying, up to this point, doing very well indeed. And yet, you see, the people won't acquiesce in his judgment. I find no fault in him. They keep pressing the matter, pressing the matter. And what they keep saying is because now they get all the people stirred up, crucify him, crucify him. Now, what he should have done at that point is obvious. He's the judge. He's made his judgment. He should have said, Jesus is free to go, go free. Or if he thought that Jesus was in danger because of this unruly mob, he should have put him under custody and kept him safe and conducted him elsewhere where he would be safe, which, by the way, a later governor did in the case of the Apostle Paul when he had heard that there were assassins trying to kill him. He surrounded him with 200 troops and he sent him off to Caesarea to get him out of there so he'd be safe. You see, that was Pilate's duty, but he didn't do that. And what he did instead was begin to waffle, began to try and weasel his way out of what was a sticky political situation. And it is because of that that Pilate is remembered so adversely all down through history and still is today. He did a number of things. First of all, he heard that he had come from an area of the country where Herod had jurisdiction. And so he sent him to Herod. He thought maybe Herod would get him off his hands. But Herod was smart. He knew what Pilate was doing. Herod just had a good time, tried to get Jesus to do a miracle, and when Jesus wouldn't do it, he sent him back to Pilate. He was a good politician, you see. He wasn't going to be trapped that way. And so that didn't work, and so Pilate said, well, I'll give them a choice. You got this man here, Barabbas. Everybody knows how bad he is. He really is an insurrectionist and a murderer. And I'll give them a choice between the innocent Jesus, just a teacher going around, a rabbi teaching. I'll give them a choice between Jesus and Barabbas. And he's astounded when they say we'd rather have Barabbas. Well, that didn't work. So he took Jesus and he gave him to the soldiers and he said, beat him up, flog him. They pressed the crowns of thorns into his head. And then when he was all beaten up and bloody and weakened, he brought him out. And it's really sad, you see, what happens here. You read it in the 19th chapter. Look, said Pilate to the Jews, I am bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him. There he is, all beaten up. To let you know, I find no basis for a charge against him. Ludicrous, you see. But he thought maybe they'd say, well, he suffered enough, let him go. And they didn't do anything of the sort. They cried out, crucify him, crucify him. Well, in the end, we know what happened. He gave in. And we read that he handed him over to be crucified, verse 16. Why did he do it? And the answer is he was afraid. It's as simple as that. Who was he afraid of? Well, afraid of the people. This great big mob was out there shouting, crucify him, crucify him. He didn't have the courage to stand against the masses. And he was afraid of Jesus, I think, because when they say later on, they finally really get down to what's bothering them. They say the reason we don't want him to live is that he makes himself out to be God. You see, that hadn't even been brought in the trial earlier. That wasn't the basis of the trial, the accusation, the examination, or the defense. But suddenly now it's come out in chapter 19, what it is that really bothers them. Now Pilate looks at it in quite a different way. Because of God, you know, I mean, he was superstitious. Verse 8, when Pilate heard that, he was even more afraid. He went back inside the palace and he said to Jesus, where do you come from? You see, the Romans really did believe in human gods and goddesses. Maybe Jesus was half God, you know, or completely God, or manifestation of one of the pagan gods. And if that was the case, he didn't want to do anything bad to Jesus. You tried to treat the gods nice, if you could. He was afraid of the people. He was afraid of Jesus. Why then, if he was afraid of the people on the one hand and afraid of Jesus on the other, did he finally give in? And the answer is that ultimately what he was afraid of was the emperor, Caesar. And you see, when they get to that point, they say to him, if you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar's. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar. When Pilate heard that, he brought Jesus out. He washed his hands of it. He said, take him away and crucify him. Now, the reason I have gone into the study of this man in the length I have is to say that we mustn't dismiss him as something that has no bearing upon ourselves. Because quite often, if you know your own heart, you know that you operate the same way. Now, not in as great a matter as this. You don't have Jesus Christ brought before you for trial. You have to pronounce a judgment on the very Son of God. Not that. But you are confronted every day in one way or another with various moral issues where you ought to stand as a Christian against what is obviously wrong. And I would be very surprised if you, in all of those instances, all the time, really have stood firm. I know I haven't. We back off. The gospel is challenged. We don't want to offend people. We retreat. And quite often we do something that is wrong. In other words, we do exactly what Pilate did, and we do it for exactly the same reasons. We do it because we're afraid. We're afraid of what people will say. We're afraid for our position, that if we are too outspoken as a Christian, we won't get ahead. We do it because we're afraid of the harm people can bring into our lives, perhaps, if we really take a righteous stand. So what I'm going to say is that although this man is strange to the story, he's a Gentile and all the others are Jews, and although he's a puzzle, he nevertheless is someone that we can identify with. And when we study Pilate, we have to say to God, what do I need that's going to keep me from doing what he did and betraying the truth, which if Jesus is the King of truth and his kingdom is the kingdom of truth, is the same thing. And the final analysis is betraying the Lord. Now, what are you going to have in order to stand firm? Let me suggest three things. First of all, you're going to have to know that God is sovereign in your life. That is, that God's in charge. And if he chooses to deliver us from the consequences that we see will come quite often, or possibly if we do the right thing, well, good, he can do that. But if he doesn't choose to do it, that's all right too, because it's in his hands, he's sovereign. That's the first thing. The second thing we need to know is the Bible, because even if we're ready to do the right thing because of the faith that we have in God's sovereignty in our lives, nevertheless, we live in a world where moral issues are very seldom presented to us in black and white terms. They're vague, gray, as we say. And so we don't know. Should we do this? Should we do that? We hear arguments on the one side, arguments on the other. This seems to be right, but then again, if we do that, certain bad things follow. This seems to be wrong, but if we do that, maybe some good things would come. You know, how do you make a decision? You have to go to the Word of God, the revelation, to get your thoughts clarified. The light of God has to shine into your light to show the right way. And then here's the third thing. You have to be willing to suffer the loss of all things if necessary in order to do the right thing. Because you see, you can say, I know that God is sovereign in my life, and you can say, in this particular instance, I study the Bible, I know what the right thing is to do, but I'm not willing to do it because the price would be too high. That's probably the saddest thing of all, but there are people who operate that way. Maybe you have done that yourself. See, if you're going to stand with Jesus Christ, you have to be willing to do what Jesus Christ did. He gave up everything, didn't he? And didn't he say to his disciples, if you're going to be my disciple, you have to deny yourself and take up your cross daily and follow me. That's a way of saying you have to die daily to your own desires, to your own possessions, to your own advancement, whatever it may be, in order to follow me. Now, it may be as you follow Christ that you'll be advanced in different ways. Many Christians are. But you see, you have to be willing to let those things go, because as long as you're hanging on to things, ultimately, as long as you're hanging on to your life, that's a price, you see, that you are unwilling to pay, and so somebody can always buy you. They have your price. They say, well, what that person values most of all is their life. We'll spare your life if you will do so-and-so, and then you capitulate or whatever it may be. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with that in a materialistic age, an age like ours, where it isn't even always great moral issues? It's just people would rather have fun than be with other Christians, or would rather have a successful career than study the Bible, or would rather be praised and liked by their unsaved friends than actually speak to them about their eternal destiny and tell them about the gospel and the value of their soul. I don't know how we're going to overcome that, but I think that of the three, that's the greatest problem today. And what we certainly need are Christian men and women who are able and willing and actually will pay the price as models so that others may see them and say, well, that is what it means to be a Christian, and that is what I'll do. Let me say one final thing. You know what really brought Pilate down is when they said to him, and you read it there in John 19, if you let this man go, you're no friend of Caesar. You see, what he wanted to be was a friend of Caesar more than anything. And yet the tragedy of it is that he wasn't Caesar's friend. Caesar hardly knew who he was. And if that's what you want, if more than anything else you want to be a friend of the world, learn this, you are not the world's friend. The world may be nice to you a little bit if they get what they want out of you, but you're not a friend of the world, and the world is no friend to you. Jesus said the world will hate you if you're my disciple. That's the truth. But that doesn't mean you don't have any friends, because Jesus Christ himself said, before this I've called you servants, but now, he said, I call you friends. Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, that sovereign God who became flesh, declares himself your friend if you're his disciple. And here was Pilate standing before the greatest friend that ever was, an eternal friend, and he allowed him to be crucified because he wanted to have a friend in Caesar. And I just say to you, don't make that mistake. Recognize that Jesus is a friend worth having. And even if you lose everything here, you probably won't, but even if you do, if you lose everything here, it's worth it to have a friend like Jesus. And it's the people like that who actually make a difference in the world.
You're listening to the Bible Study Hour, featuring the teaching of Dr. James Boyce. Pilate betrayed Jesus by condemning an innocent man, but Judas betrayed him as a friend and follower. If you'd like to learn more about the disciples' infamous betrayal and the warning it holds for Christians today, we'd like to offer you a free copy of our CD entitled Jesus and Judas, also by James Boyce. This free CD offer is just our way of saying we're grateful that you're listening. Give us a call at 1-800-488-1888. We'd be pleased to send you a copy of Jesus and Judas. Dr. Boyce was a great champion for the inerrancy of Scripture. He served on the International Council of Biblical Inerrancy, and he preached the Bible faithfully. Would you help keep his messages on the air by making a tax-deductible gift to this ministry today? You can make your donation online at thebiblestudyhour.org. You can also call us directly. Our number is 1-800-488-1888. Our postal address is 600 Eden Road, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 17601. Thanks. We appreciate your support. Think and Act Biblically is Dr. Boyce's daily devotional that corresponds with the message you just heard on the Bible Study Hour. Read and subscribe to Think and Act Biblically at thebiblestudyhour.org. I'm Mark Daniels. Thank you for joining me today. She watched him die on the cross, and with his death, her faith and hope had vanished. Yet her love for him never wavered, because love is eternal, and she loved him exceedingly. Join Dr. James Boyce next time on the Bible Study Hour as he examines the most poignant and touching of Jesus' encounters in all the Gospels. That's next time on the Bible Study Hour, preparing you to think and act biblically.